You are listening to the Hirschsprung's Hour on UK Health Radio, where I interview incredible people with a connection to Hirschsprung's disease and other associated conditions, such as IBD, IBS, Crohn's, colitis, and ulcerative colitis. Each week, I bring you a new and exciting interview with people from all walks of life, including charity founders, models, and professional sports people. We go through the ups and downs of having Hirschsprung's with a positive message throughout. Hello and welcome to episode 53 of Tom's Hirschsprung's podcast. We are celebrating the 1 year anniversary of the show, and I have not one, but two very special guests with me today. I'm joined once again by a man that you would have heard a couple of weeks ago in Fred Gray. Fred, welcome back.
Hello. Fantastic to be back. Thank you very much for having me.
And I'm also joined by a very special man indeed, and we're going to talk about his career at Great Ormond Street Hospital. I'm also joined by Joe Curry. Welcome, Joe.
Hi, thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks so much, both of you, for coming on. This is indeed a very, very special episode, and so glad that we could do this for our 1 year anniversary. So thank you so much, both of you, for making the time on this cold Tuesday evening. Thank you. Now, as we said at the beginning, we're going to talk mainly about your career, Joe, and how important that's been. For anybody who doesn't know, you are a surgeon at Great Ormond Street Hospital. Would you like to just explain a little bit about what you do?
So I'm one of a team of surgeons at Great Ormond Street. We might refer to ourselves as general paediatric surgeons, but all of us have particular interests in our practice, and my particular interest is in operating on children who've got lower bowel conditions, mostly congenital conditions, means that they were born with those.
Yep. Fantastic. Excellent. And obviously Hirschsprung's being very much a speciality of yours.
Yeah, absolutely. Hirschsprung's and another condition called anorectal malformation would be the two sort of focused areas for my career.
Excellent. And with that in mind, it kind of brings me to my first question. You specialise, as you said, in Hirschsprung sort of IBD, sort of lower intestinal. What sort of attracted you to specialising in those conditions?
Well, I think there's, you know, for the surgeon, there's always something about the challenge of a complicated operating procedure, and those two conditions are ones where the operation is delicate. It needs to be done well. It needs to be done regularly to have a good outcome. But I think what really for me, beyond those two conditions, is that actually the care of children with Hirschsprung's and this other condition, anorectal malformation, is literally 5 or 10% of their care is the operation. The rest of the care for those children is looking after the child and the family as they grow through their early childhood, their school experience as they go into puberty, and then eventually as they transition. And that ability to form a relationship with a family, to meet them at the start of their child's birth, and to know that you're going to be with them on that journey right up until they're 18, is an amazing journey to be on and to share, and to do your best for that family, to give the best outcome for the child. So we love the surgery. We want to be in the operating theatre doing these operations, but the support and care of the family after, the development of that relationship with them, is just beautiful. And I think one of the reasons why people do this job of paediatric surgery is that relationship you form with your families.
Absolutely. And I know, Fred, that you and I have both gone through Great Ormond Street. Would you like to just sort of talk a little bit about, well, what Joe just said there in terms of that relationship? Because I know you and I both know that the Great Ormond Street is such a special place.
Absolutely. Yeah. I got discharged, set into the wild when I was, 17, 18. And it was a really, it felt like a second. It was second home. It was never somewhere I was scared to be. My relationship with the hospital itself was just care and love and how personable the place was. Just I mean, it's particularly Mr. Kiley, just going to see him was comforting. I mean, I felt that as a young child. I certainly know how much affection my parents had for all the doctors there, particularly Mr. Kiley. And yeah, it was just that foundation. And actually, it was the care that I received that I believe led, well, I know led to my brother, who is now a very successful pediatric consultant in Salisbury. It was seeing his brother's life being saved and maintained, and as Mr. Curry says, it wasn't just the operations that I had; it was the care that I received afterwards. And it was that was the motivation. And now we've got another fantastic doctor, doing the same thing. And it's sort of generationally, you create a care system that is working and is good.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And kind of, yeah. And I guess also when it comes sort of right round to this podcast, without the care that I received, this podcast wouldn't be happening. And, if I hadn't had such a great experience at Great Ormond Street, then I wouldn't be doing this show. So yeah. So Great Ormond Street is an incredibly special place, to me. And I know, Mr. Curry, you talked about the relationship with parents, but what is it about? Because I know you said you've been at Great Ormond Street since 2001. What is it about Great Ormond Street that really makes the place special?
Well, I think it's got everything under one roof for families, and I think that it's both one of the really great things about the hospital, which is that many of our children have complicated problems and need help from many different teams in the organization, and they're all on one site. And I think the ability of the families to feel that their care is under one ceiling is really reassuring. It's a challenge for us when it comes to our patients leaving and transitioning, that sometimes that care can be a little bit fractured and end up being in a couple of adult hospitals to receive that same level of care. But nevertheless, I think that ability to be all-encompassing and holistic for a child is really important. But I also it what strikes me every time I walk into the hospital is that sometimes I don't feel like I'm walking into a hospital. You walk into an adult hospital and immediately it's a hospital. You have all the trappings of that, but you're walking into a place that feels a lot more homely, a lot more friendly and welcoming. And yeah, it has a very different feel and a different ethos. And I would hope that comes across in some of our families. When they're spending a long time in the building, that they don't feel like they're confined in a hospital. It's for some, as close to being a comforting second home for them.
Yeah, definitely. And I think certainly things that will stick with me for the rest of my life, things like the Peter Pan Cafe that will always stick with me for the rest of my life. And the little red bus that's right next to the door, is that still there?
No, the little red bus
No.
is no more. No, that went with one
No.
of our first upgrades to the entrance to the hospital. And indeed, I think that the whole of the front of the hospital is being redesigned and rebuilt as a new children's cancer centre, which will be an amazing state-of-the-art environment for children for the future.
Yes, absolutely. Of course, you had the Gosh 5K to raise money for that cancer centre that actually I met a previous guest, Paul Bolson, the head of governance and membership. He was on the podcast very recently, so I met him there, and that was a fantastic event. So yeah, if anybody, and that happens sort of around every October time, I believe, the Gosh 5K. So if anybody, and you can run it, walk it, do whatever you want. So anybody who wants to do that, absolutely feel free. It's a fantastic event. It really is. But if we go back to you and your career, and in the research I was doing for this, that it's the numbers of articles and conferences that really stood out to me. If it's all right, I'll reel off a couple of stats with you again. If they're wrong, please correct me. I got them from the NHS website, so if they're wrong, I'm sorry. But 110 peer-reviewed articles and 17 book chapters, and presenting over 125 times to national and international conferences. Does that kind of blow your mind a little bit in terms of just the scale and the amount?
Yeah, I never imagined that for myself at the start of my career, because I just envisaged that I would just be a hardworking surgeon, and that actually getting involved in kind of research and presenting work wouldn't be such a feature. But actually, the volume of patients that we have at this trust and the complexity of them is that we've learned lots of important lessons about how patients are treated and about outcomes from surgery. And it's really important that that information is shared. And you know, there are surgeons up and down the country who are working in their centers who are doing similar things as well, and looking to share so that we can be a community of surgeons who learn from each other and are able to do things better the year after from compared to the previous year. But yeah, I found that work it very interesting. It's kept me enthused in the specialty. It's enabled me to stay up to date so that I can look at my patients in the eye and say, yeah, I'm offering you what I think is state-of-the-art treatment because I've kept myself up with what's happening, with what the medical literature is doing, with what new research is out there and available for you. So yeah, it's and I'd say to any children's surgeon who's practicing, keep involved, keep learning. It's a lifelong learning process. Don't ever think that you've learned everything you need to know because there's something new around the corner and you need to be there and have it available for you.
That's brilliant. And
I
it's
just ask
really,
Paul?
go for it. Yes.
Just because on the subject of things evolving and changing and improving, I don't even remember, but you actually met my son Dylan in Great Ormond Street, and you met me as well. We were probably a bit frazzled at the time, but obviously my dad had it, then I had it, and now my son has it, and apparently that's very rare. Is that very rare?
It's uncommon, let's say. I wouldn't put it in the rare category because it's a condition we're understanding more and more about and understanding the genetic nature.
Okay, but already, and I don't want to, jinx anything because, of course, I don't. But Dylan is incredible in terms of how he is, in terms of his potty training, in terms of his control, in terms of his, we can talk about it in this, but in terms of consistency of poo, all that sort of stuff. It's just so vastly different to my experience. Not one that I remember, because obviously, I've been told these things. But I had to have a special diet where I could only eat boiled potatoes and boiled chicken for like a year, year and a half, because all I could process. I was in for 2 years. He was in maybe for like 4 months, maybe in total. I haven't added it up. I had emergency life-saving operations. He didn't. I mean, it was obviously still scary and et cetera, et cetera. But the difference between his, and also, the size of the scar. I remember I said on the last podcast about showing Mr. DeCoppi my scar and saying, "Will it look like this?" And he was like, "No." This keyhole. What are the actual, what in what way in the last 40 years has it improved? Like definitive ways. Does that make sense as a question?
Yeah, I think one of the things, and it's a slightly strange way to start to answer the question, but one of the things that hasn't changed is that we're actually still doing pretty much the same reconstructive operations that were designed in the late 1940s and early 1950s.
Wow.
But and so in concept, actually how we're treating it surgically hasn't really changed, but of course everything around that has. So just to give a couple of examples, the antibiotics that we would now use to minimize the risk of infection and their ability to be very specific is better than 20 years ago, and it's certainly better than 40 years ago. The anesthetics that children have now and the agents that are used for anesthetic are a quantum safer than they were 20 years ago and definitely 40 years ago. So a child's ability to have multiple operations in a safe way without any drugs that would harm the body system or the liver particularly is so much better. The materials that we use in terms of the suture materials are better. Some of them are now impregnated themselves with antibiotic. So it's kind of everything around the conduct of what is still the same operation is just so much better than it was before.
Right.
And they're what was brilliantly coined by the guy who helped the British cycling team, Brailsford, Chris Brailsford, I think, who said that it's about marginal gains. It's about the impact of lots of little things improving in the way the same basic operation is conducted that suddenly starts to show itself in terms of recovery and ability to undergo major procedures, recover incredibly quickly, have a much better profile of complications that you would have had, even in that generation ago.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
Absolutely right with that, the Brailsford marginal gains. I've heard that a lot. I work in the sports field, so yes, we hear that an awful lot. It's a shame you can't do it with Man United at the moment. But
oh dear, let's not talk about football.
Oh, we have to, I have a Newcastle fan. I have to get my jibes in when I can. sorry, back to the matter at hand. I love talking to people about Hirschsprungs and how it's changed. Because it essentially, if I'm wrong, please correct. But the pull through is still very much the pull through. I mean, there's three different ways of doing it. But everybody who has Hirschsprungs goes through the pull through. But it's amazing to me that, you know, people won't have what I would call. I don't know if anybody listening would know what this is, but I call it my train track scar because it just looks like a giant train track going all the way through. And the fact that things have changed a lot now is I find that I just find it really, really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen families where there's a very strange condition we treat called pyloric stenosis, where the muscle of the exit of the stomach becomes too big. And children have sickness, and there's a very, very good and very simple operation that we use to treat that. And because that also runs in families, I have seen a generation from great granddad to dad to child all having the same condition, and each one has a different scar. And of course, the baby now has had keyhole surgery, so has almost no scarring at all. And you can see how those generations of scars have developed over posterity for again what is still in essence the exact same operation, but the challenges of having this one operation, but saying, you know, how can we do this operation but do it better? How can we do it and have a faster recovery? How can we do it and have a less rate of complications and infection? Those are the kind of challenges that we need to rise to.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, that's the thing that kind of struck me with Great Ormond Street, just as a whole, in the fact that they're just constantly striving to just be the best, and just constantly. It was the way I felt when I was there for 16 years or so. When I left, I think 2008 was the last time I was there. But yeah, it was what I felt. Great Ormond Street, they were just constantly striving to be better and better and better. And that's exactly what you've said. But moving on to something a little bit different, your TV career. Star of A Chance at Life, a fantastic documentary in 2012 with you and Mr. Kyler. There's a wonderful photo that I saw when I was trying to find this, but unfortunately couldn't. There's a wonderful photo with you and Mr. Kyler standing side by side that I thought it brought back very, very good memories for me. So I thought that was fantastic. But in terms of that documentary in and in of itself, what was it like sort of trying to do your job and also having a TV film crew there? Did it sort of, were you aware of them, or were you just sort of super focused on doing what you're doing?
Yeah, I the latter is certainly true. I mean, there was no element of any distraction from the normal preparation and move up towards the surgical procedure. I must say that the team who were doing the filming conducted themselves brilliantly. They, you talk about fly on the wall, they really were that. They were very much in the background and were very responsive. If we said, I think we should stop at this point, or I'm not ready to do this, they were very willing and able to respond to the environment that they were in and the situation that they were in. And I think that something about that gave them an ability to be able to capture the moment as it really should be, because of the fact that they were so non-intrusive. And so I think the legitimacy of it and the reality of it really came across.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I know, Fred, you've seen that documentary as well. What were your sort of overriding thoughts?
Well, I was I was really struck by, well, I'm sort of always, I always ask my brother about this. It's a sort of, because I've moved on to be a like an actor, director, man, and I still don't feel like I've really grown up. So like, so people who do real things with their lives, kind of just, I'm in awe of them, and you take that to the extreme, which is saving people's lives. I put doctors on a pedestal, maybe because obviously my life was saved, and now my son and stuff, and my brother and my sister-in-law, et cetera, et cetera. But I have this respect for them because I could never do it. I wouldn't be brave enough. I wouldn't, I have a bad day at work or whatever. I take it home with me. But a bad day at work for me is, I missed a line. It's like, it doesn't matter. No one noticed. It doesn't matter. But a bad day at work in that context, when you're dealing with a chance at life, you're dealing with potential death. Like, I suppose what really struck me about the documentary is that I was able to see a sort of godlike figure in Mr. Kiley in terms of my own personal relationship with him, and obviously listening to Mr. Curry as well, who I didn't have a personal relationship with, but was still just as interesting. Sorry, Mr. Curry. Was just hearing a human being talk about the struggles, about the ways in which it's easy and ways in which it's difficult, and the ways it, and it just sort of blew my mind. It just, I think someone put the question to Mr. Cardi about, do you take it home? And he said, well, you can't really. You can't really. You have to just worry about doing your job there and then. And you can't worry about 20 years down the line. You can take step by step, and you're with them and sort of taking them through that process. But it's not about, you just have to do the best of your ability and try and give them the best chance at life. So I suppose if I could ask a question, Tom, like, do you find, Mr. Curry, that it's difficult to leave the job at the door? Do you find you have to find protective barriers in terms of, they say like gallows humor and things, like with doctors and things. Like, have you developed that sort of force field? Yeah, I suppose there's lots of questions in there all at once. How do you do it, basically?
Oh, easy questions. I suppose I'd relate an experience when I was working in an intensive care environment in an adult setting and at the early part of my training, and there was a patient who actually was a pediatric patient, and it was the first time in my career where I'd got to know a patient and the family around them really very well. And the patient was really sick, and I came into work on the Monday morning, having left on the Friday, and I went into the room where the patient was, just opened the door, and there was nobody in the room, and the bed was empty, and the patient had died, and I just, it was the first time in my entire career where I realized that I'd opened up a little bit, and I'd really got a connection with this family. And I went to the funeral. I was invited to the funeral, myself and two of the nurses who were known by the family really well. And boy, that was hard. And I kind of said to myself, I'm not sure I can do that again. I'm not sure that I could form a relationship with somebody in that way and be able to step away from it and then just say, oh, that happened today, and then come to work tomorrow. Wow. And so yes, there's a little bit about having the kind of resilience is a term that's used a lot nowadays, which I think is that ability to be able to overcome the downs of your career and still be able to come to work and do what you do tomorrow. But I don't think anybody really, certainly not in pediatric surgery, could say that each one of those events is etched on you a little bit and you carry it a bit. And Ed's saying that he doesn't take it home. If I didn't take it home and speak to my wife about it, I would be nowhere. I need somebody who can bounce that kind of stuff off me. You can feel now it's really raw. But it, yeah, and I think that's probably what makes pediatric surgeons is that they do have that little bit more about us, about the experience of the family and being involved in that way. But it's very tough. And again, and it it hurt a lot during that particular episode as well. And it's embarrassing to say that it hurt you because you're not the family who've lost their child, but it's tough to get over those things, and it takes a lot to come back and do it all again the following day. And I think by the time you come into the end of your career, there's something about you that wants to still do the job. You really want, you enjoy the surgical challenge because, we do enjoy that. But there's also a little bit of you that thinks the one thing that I want to kind of lay down and not have to deal with anymore is the emotional challenge and the baggage that you carry. And all of the good things that you do and all of the successes are great, and they do mitigate against the things that don't go so well, and the outcomes for patients that are sad, but it doesn't make them go away completely.
Thank you. Thank you.
No. I know you've got to shoot off in a sec, Fred, but I will ask one more question that I believe, but certainly I want to know, and I presume you want to know as well, is that we have talked about but your two colleagues that you worked alongside for many years, Professor Spitz and Mr. Kiley. In terms of those two wonderful surgeons, what were they like to work with?
Wow. Well, you can imagine that I turned up in 2002 is when I started my consultant career. And I was surrounded by these two guys who, between them, had half a century of experience. And we on a Thursday morning, we used to have this session whereby we'd look back at some of the patients that we treated during the course of the week. And it was a great opportunity where we'd discuss the case, we'd look at X-rays, we'd talk about the surgery and the treatment that they'd had, and the trainees were all, like this, listening, because it was just absolute great experience. And I remember vividly on one occasion where we showed an X-ray of a child, and Lewis looked at Ed, and Ed looked at Lewis, and they both said to each other, "We've never seen this before." And there was a bit of me that just went, "Oh my God, they've never seen it before. What am I going to do?" But there was also a bit of me that was kind of excited that again, the challenge of pediatric surgery is that you're going to come across things that you've never seen before, and the challenge is in utilizing all the experience from your previous treatments, the conditions you've recognized, to bring that to bear to treat a family. So it was incredibly exciting to have that, as well as being nervous. But the one thing that really struck me about these two guys was that they were never in competition with each other. They were never afraid to say the things they'd done well, but they were also, very importantly, not afraid to say the things that they'd done badly or that had not gone well, so that they could learn from each other. And that collective supporting mentality going forward is, I think, one of the things that me and Paolo, is my colleague who's here, and my other colleagues as well, really want to continue to bring forward, that it's an open, honest environment, and Lewis and Ed really set the foundation for that.
Fantastic. Fred, is there anything I know you've got to shoot off in a bit, anything else you'd like to ask or add?
I had those two questions lined up. It's just a genuine, real privilege to speak to you. So thank you so much.
Not at all. Pleasure.
No, thank you so much for coming on, Fred.
Of course. Thank you for having me again.
No, pleasure. You're welcome back anytime.
Merry Christmas to you both.
Yes,
And
you
you.
too. Happy New
Bye-bye.
Year.
See you later. Bye-bye.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
Thank you. Fantastic. I mean, as you can probably tell, myself and Fred hold all three of you in just the highest regard we possibly could. I mean, you saved our lives. I can't say enough good things, and neither can Fred as well. We're recording this before Fred's episode has come out, but in his episode, he does talk very, very highly about his care at Great Ormond Street. And as we sort of get towards the back half and this episode, I'd love to talk about conjoined twins with you, because there was something I saw when doing my research on the NHS website. There was in 2023, there was a, well, there is every year, but a conjoined twins day. And in 2023, you had a celebration for conjoined twins day, and there was a lot of conjoined twins brought back. Was that something that you also wanted to specialize in, as well as sort of Hirschsprungs and IBD, or was it something that you sort of learned sort of later on?
I mean, I experienced it from the very start when I was here as a trainee before I took up consultant post in 2002. I saw again Lewis and Ed bringing all of their experience to bear on separation of conjoined twins. Some of the separations are very swift and very straightforward. Some of them are immensely complex, operating times over 24 hours, four or five surgical teams involved. And interestingly, I guess one of the interests for me is that, part of the separation process and the mechanism of connection of conjoined twins does often involve complex surgery on the lower bowel. So it was a natural progression for me to marry both of those experiences together. And it's the operations are immense, as I said. The preparation involved, the personnel involved to prepare for that is phenomenal. And again, Lewis and Ed set the scene. Set the standard really as to what a successful separation operation looks like, which is often many months in planning and many, many hours in conduct, and then many years in follow-up. And one of the things that I was keen to do for was to bring all the families together so that the many teams involved in their care could see them all in one day. And there's lots of logistical advantages in terms of multiple visits to the hospital. But there was seemed this amazing opportunity for the families to meet each other and to share their experiences, because these operations and this condition is incredibly rare. And all of a sudden, these families are finding themselves in a room with six or seven other families who've been through the same journey. And the discussion and the camaraderie and the enjoyment of the day was there for all to see. So that we, there was a little bit of medicine and a little bit of surgery follow-up in there, but actually it was just a joyous day of families having fun and sharing amazing experiences.
That's fantastic. And this obviously conjoined twins day happens every year, 24th of November. I've got in my notes. I believe that's about right. Was there is this something sort of planning to do each year or every other year?
We're not sure at the moment. I think we're just sourcing some feedback from the families just to see what the experience has been like, and discussing it amongst colleagues here. It's logistically a lot of work for some of our admin staff to bring the whole day together. So we've done it twice. We're in a process of reflection about the future now.
Fantastic. Excellent. And then just sort of going back, I know we've sort of dipped in and out and in and out of your career, and weaved it through other things of Ed's career and Lewis's career as well. But you kind of all to me it's quite a surreal moment, because to me you're all intertwined with each other. I saw one of the three of you each time whenever I went every 6 weeks to Great Ormond Street. So it is a, yeah, it's a very odd feeling I've got at the moment. but I imagine you, when you see patients, because obviously you see them from, or have seen them sort of right from birth all the way till adulthood, do you get sort of a satisfaction in seeing some patients that you've seen all the way through?
Yeah, incredibly. And I think one of the things that I see from families is when they come back, they're seeing somebody who's quite literally known their child as long as they have. And the development of that relationship is one that we should never take for granted. And it's lovely for a family to come into a clinic room, and there may be a in old times a big set of clinical notes. Nowadays it's all electronic, but I can just turn around to the family and say, how are you? Because I know them so well. I know the journey. I know every operation the child's had, and I've known the family. And I think the comfort that that brings them of knowing that they're with somebody who they don't have to start that whole journey again. And of course, I can't see every single patient every time they come to the hospital. Families will come and they'll see the doctors who are working in my team at that time. But at the end of every clinic, we will talk about every single patient that's been seen. So I get an update on every one of my patients in every clinic that I attend. But yeah, it's an incredible journey. It's tough. I've now been here long enough where I'm saying goodbye to some of my patients, and let me tell you, that's quite an emotional time as well. Is them going out into the world and starting their adult journey. And you know, we talk a lot about transition and the challenges of transitioning children from pediatric surgery into adult services, and it remains a challenge. But my focus for families now is to make sure that young adult who's going into the world knows absolutely everything about themselves that they need to know. It's important parents note, but I want that young adult to know exactly who they are, what operation they've had, what's their diagnosis, and specifically what their diagnosis is, so that they can advocate for themselves as they move forward with their life.
Absolutely. No, that sounds both incredibly challenging and a fantastic thing to do as well. I mean, having gone through that myself, in terms of when I left at 16, and I think I didn't necessarily transfer into the adult hospital. I think there was it was kind of if I needed it type thing, but I didn't sort of go back to regular checkups like I had been with Great Ormond Street. Is that sort of how it works now? Is it sort of just case by case?
It's a little bit case by case, but we have to acknowledge that adult services are stretched, they're overworked, their ability to take on patients who aren't part of a cancer pathway, for example, means that they're really struggling to take on some of our patients who have real need, but they're not life-threatening leads. They're not, as I say, they're not a cancer diagnosis, but they're very much affecting quality of life. But the challenges of the modern NHS in terms of waiting times and trying to be seen by specialists is a really difficult one. And so there are real challenges in trying to seek the kind of care that they've had, particularly at this hospital, which has all of the ologies under one roof, and that holistic view of care is difficult. And it's not for the want of wanting to be involved from our adult colleagues. It's just sometimes the necessity of the patient load and the pressures that have been put on them by the needs of their other patients. So it's a difficult one. And I think
Absolutely.
in the past we've been, I think our specialty has been guilty of conducting operations and saying to patients, "You're fixed, you're cured." And I would always say for patients with complex anorectal conditions that you're not really cured. You need to continue to be supported and managed and helped. And some need a lot of help and some need very little help, but they all need some form of help, and we shouldn't be abandoning our patients.
No. Definitely. And I think that's what certainly, I've talked to people with Hirschsprungs all over the world, and they had some of their doctors there and said, right, you're 16, 18 now, everything's fine, you're all cured. It's like, well, you still have, Hirschsprungs. That bit of the bowel didn't suddenly grow back overnight, for example. So I think that sort of managed care, and I think for me, and again, just sort of personally, I felt as though, even though I wasn't going back every 6 weeks, 3 months, whatever it was, I still felt that Great Ormond Street were on the end of the phone. They were still, even though I wasn't seeing anybody there, they still cared for me, even though I wasn't there, which sort of gave me and I guess my parents as well a great sense of security.
Yeah, I can see that connection and that feeling that there's somebody you can go to. Again, one of the stresses of transition is families potentially losing some of the comfort of knowing that there's somebody they can reach out to.
Absolutely. So just also as we sort of wind towards the end here, in terms of your career. Obviously, we've talked about a lot of things that you've achieved. Was there anything that you look back now and you think that's one thing I've achieved that I'm really, I mean, there'll be loads of things that you're really, really proud of, but is there anything specifically that stands out for you?
One of the kind of passions of what I've done has been about training and being involved in training the next generation of pediatric surgeons. And, you know, I look back over my career, I've probably been involved in training, I would say 50, 60 surgeons who are now practicing pediatric surgery up and down the country. And I think if I was to be remembered with for one legacy, it would be to say that I've been involved in training all of those people. And when I say training, what I mean is passing on everything that I'd learned from people like Lewis Bitts and Ed Kiley. And I would say Ed Kiley is, without a shadow of a doubt, the best technical surgeon I've seen in children's surgery. Just the art and craft of his skills are immeasurable, and the little bits of that I've been able to reproduce, because I don't think anybody will ever be him again. But he had a lot of important lessons and things that needed to be known about how to do operations safely and well and regularly, and I've done my best to try and hand that on to another generation of surgeons, and hope that they will do what I've done, but do it better, and then they'll have a generation of people who'll do it even better than them, and that legacy can snowball and spiral and really inspire the next generation.
So it's more about legacy for you, which again kind of ties into my a lot of thoughts with Great Ormond Street. That when I ask you about what are you really proud of, you talk about other people and talk about actually I care about other people and it's not about me and it's about these other people. And that's just really, really interesting, because that's what I get from Great Ormond Street. It's all about I want to care for other people. So yeah, I found that answer incredibly interesting. But it's a fantastic place, and will hopefully always be a fantastic place for many, many years to come. I know did had to shoot off, but I know Fred's feelings on Great Ormond Street, as he mentioned before, are cannot rate the place highly enough. And the same for me. I can't rate Great Ormond Street highly enough. I think it's fantastic, and I think in terms of world-class care, I know there are lots of people who do lots of fantastic things, but for me, and I'm being very biased here, and I make no bones about it, it will always be the best hospital in the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's if a hospital has to aspire, I think, to want to do nothing other than the best for its patients and to care for its staff who do that. And I frequently operate in other hospitals around, and sometimes I'm asked to get involved in some very, very complex operations because people have the view that I can do really complex operations, and I'm always keen to bring them back down to earth to say, look, the only reason I can do this operation is because when I do it here, I'm surrounded by the best. I'm surrounded by amazing anaesthetists, amazing colleagues and support workers, amazing other specialties that support what I do, nursing staff with highly specialized skills, intensive care unit that are miraculous in what they can do. That's the reason I can do what I do. You can't just take me out, put me in a field, and expect me to do some of the operations that I do and expect it to work out well, because it's not me. It's not one person. It's the team, and it reflects back what we were talking about with conjoined twins, that if you are going to have success in that field of surgery, then you have to reflect and acknowledge the absolute army of people behind you that do that. I always think of the racing car analogy. There's Lewis Hamilton in his car driving around setting the world on fire, but the army of people behind him who put that car together such that he can do what he does is often unseen and sometimes not potentially getting the credit they deserve, although I'm sure they do from their own team. But there is that group of people behind you who allow you to do what you do. So
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a fantastic sentiment to finish on. I think all that's left for me to say is, I know Fred's not here, but thank you to Fred for joining me. And thank you to you for joining me. Thank you to you for everything you've done for me, my family, for Fred, for families across Great Ormond Street. Thanks to Mr. Spitz and Mr. Kiley as well. They've been integral in saving my life. I owe my life to them. And Fred as well, I know, and countless others. So thank you very much to the magical trio. Thank you very much for coming.
not at all. Been an absolute pleasure. Love talking to you, Fred.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye bye.
Thank you for listening to the Hirschsprungs Hour on UK Health Radio. You can find me on Facebook under Tom's Hirschsprungs Podcast or Instagram on Tom's_Hirschsprungs_podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show and we'll bring you another episode soon.